Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
I ask everyone to turn their phones off. Now I haven't started yet, but we put this function on at very late notice, so thanks for coming, everyone, and let's turn our phones off. Well, thanks for coming along tonight in this wet Sydney night and at late notice, and it's great to have Wayne Swan back at the Sydney Institute. The Treasurer and Deputy Prime Minister is probably one of the best-known Australians, so I won't introduce him. He's so well-known, except to say that Wayne Swan's been at the Institute on a number of times before. He's always welcome, and it's great to have him back. And tonight, the Deputy Prime Minister and the Treasurer will be talking on Labor's economic plan and the stability and prosperity Australians deserve. Mr. Swan, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Gerard. It's good to be here with Anne. It's good to be back here at the Sydney Institute, which is a very important forum for the discussion of public policy in our great country. And of course, tonight, as we all weigh in the balance, who will form the next government of Australia, my point tonight is that economic management is absolutely crucial, absolutely central to that decision. Now, obviously, I have a very strong view that the return of a Labor government will best secure and advance strong economic management in this country and certainly build on the outstanding results we saw in the national accounts yesterday. I want to talk tonight about where we are, where we have come from and where we're going in terms of economic policy, because we all recognise that we are now living through an extraordinary time in our political life, a time when there are very big decisions to be made about our future. And I would say that perhaps today there is not sufficient recognition of just how serious the choices before us are, of how much they will determine our future prosperity and, of course, our economic security. Unusually, in the election and through to today, there has been an economic conversation and a political conversation, but the two seem to have gone in opposite directions. What I want to do today is to link them up, the economic story of Australia and, of course, the political story. And, of course, I'm going to start tonight in a rather unlikely and perhaps boring place. And the place I want to start is with the publication number 5625 of the Australian Bureau of Statistics, the latest which was released just 1 week ago. Its full title is Private New Capital Expenditure and Expected Expenditure, or what they call in the trade as CapEx. Now, for those of us in the economics game, it's a very interesting release because it tells us not only about current business investment in Australia, but what businesses are planning to invest importantly in the future. Now, in terms of where we are now, you would hardly be astonished to learn that the volume of business investment in the June quarter of this year was down nearly 5% from 1 year earlier. Now, there are various reasons for this, but of course the main reason is that investment decisions are made a year or so before the spending actually takes place. Investment in the June quarter this year reflects investment decisions taken last year at a time when the global outlook was very bleak and there was a real risk that Australia itself would tumble into a long slump. So there's no surprise there whatsoever. But the big news was not the actual investment in the June quarter. That's not the importance of this publication. It was in expected investment over 2010-11, which of course is the current financial year. And what the numbers showed was that compared to earlier estimates for the same period, investment intentions were overall very much stronger. The overall increase was 17.5%. If we compare this estimate for this year to the estimate made at the same time a year ago for the 29-10 year, it was over 24% higher. Over 24% higher. And mining was 48.4% higher. A truly stunning figure. Now, I guess you might be wondering why I would be subjecting you to some of these facts. My point is a very clear one, a very simple one, and a very important one. This survey was taken in July and August of this year. July and August of this year. In July and August, the ABS surveyed 8,000 business establishments. Now, that's a pretty big number. And it was conducted with all of the professional rigour that you would expect from the ABS. And it was, of course, conducted following a fierce campaign by parts of the mining industry. And it was also conducted at a time when the opposition was most negative in its warnings about debt and deficits and relentless in its efforts to talk down the economy. And what it showed in that survey of 8,000 businesses was that the investment plans for those businesses were very optimistic indeed, and nowhere more so, as I said before, than in the mining industry. Now, this to me seems to point to a dislocation between the economic story and the political story, between the front page of the newspapers and the business pages, between what many business leaders say for publication and what Australian businesses actually do in terms of the forthcoming economic landscape. Now, it's not only in the CapEx figures that we see this growing divide between the professional assessment of the economic outlook and what was being foretold, if you like, in a negative way, particularly by the federal opposition. Because earlier in August, we'd also seen another big increase in the level of consumer optimism as measured by Westpac. It was the second conservative monthly increase in the consumer sentiment indicator, and it left the measure not far below where it had been before the global financial crisis. That's a very important fact. And we've also seen similar outcomes when it comes to the NAB business survey, which also improved in the June quarter. Now, I'm not going to go through a raft of other data, but we've had business indicators, we've had retail sales, we've had record quarterly trade surplus figures on Tuesday. All of these figures show an economy which is in excellent shape. And, of course, that's all before you get to the national accounts figures, which came out yesterday, because they really do bring together much of this data and underscore the strength of our economy. And you couldn't get in those national accounts data a better endorsement of our economy and its performance in difficult global times than the set of figures that we actually received yesterday. And what we see in those figures is that the nature of growth is following the plan that we mapped out for our economy and for its recovery when the global financial crisis hit. The stimulus that kept the economy afloat through the darkest days of the global economy is continuing to unwind, and the private sector is stepping up to take its place, just as it should do. Now, if the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of the UK or Japan, or the Chancellor of Germany could point to numbers like these, they would be very happy leaders indeed. So my point is that we do have a very solid economy. We've had a very solid economy before the election, and it is still very solid right now. The GDP outcome for Australia is important for another reason as well, because what we see here in the final instalment for financial year 29-10 is that we have now seen the end of the 19th year of continuous economic growth in Australia. It draws the curtain on that chapter, 19 years of continuous economic growth. And of course, that says something very important about our economy, because there's no other advanced economy that can talk about 19 years of continuous growth. My point about all of this is that it sets up a very solid foundation a very solid foundation indeed for Australia's future. Now, I'll say a bit more about our record, but I won't go on too long because I most importantly tonight want to talk about the future. But I do want to recap a little on 2007 and 2008. Now, when we came to office in 2007 with lots of plans for infrastructure, for spending on universities and training, and for other investments to plug the very serious investment gaps in our economy, we took these very seriously. But we found we were constrained by the rising level of inflation. We were determined then not to overburden an economy already pushing up against pretty severe capacity constraints. And of course, we had seen where excessive spending in an economy at capacity could lead at that time. It was called the Howard Costello Spendathon of Mining Boom Mark I. And of course, you would all recall that that ended with interest rates, 10 interest rate rises in a row. So when we were first elected, we had to walk that fine line between responsible fiscal policy and making the investments the country needed to lift its growth potential. And I believe we did that successfully. Then, of course, we had the collapse of Lehman Brothers a year after we took office. So we had our first year or 1 year of tackling inflation, and then we had to turn everything around and tackle the impact of what was a very savage global recession. So we went rapidly from building economic capacity to protecting economic capacity. And I'm very glad to say that we succeeded in our endeavours there. I certainly agree that the Reserve Bank of Australia played a superb role in responding as quickly as it did and with the force that it did to those changed circumstances. And of course, I agree that Australia was helped because our banks had not lent recklessly or funded themselves without sufficient regard to risk. And of course, it is true that China's growth played a role, though, as the RBA recently pointed out, it was not as big as commonly believed. But there can be no question at all that fiscal policy played a central role in fighting off the effects of the global recession. And of course, the Reserve Bank itself endorses that view, so does the Treasury, the OECD, and the IMF. And of course, it has been backed by most of Australia's leading economists who had this to say just in August this year. We, the undersigned economists, are convinced by the evidence that the coordinated policies of the Australian Labor Government have prevented the Australian economy from a deep recession and prevented a massive increase in unemployment. Our fiscal stimulus did make a very substantial difference. It was carefully designed to hit the economy before monetary policy could take effect and then to fade as the economy recovered. Now, we've come through this with about half the unemployment rate of Europe or the United States and with one of the strongest economies in the developed world. And, of course, we've seen again, as I said before this week, strong underlying growth. Now, at the same time we put in place our stimulus strategy, we also put in place a fiscal strategy to restore the budget to surplus. We've followed those rules to the letter, with the budget now on track to return to surplus in 2012-13, 3 years early and before any major advanced economy. Given the global challenges our nation confronted, we couldn't do everything, and we don't claim every single program went perfectly. But what we did do, and what we've achieved in 3 years, I believe, is formidable. The biggest long-term achievement of our government and of our country was keeping Australia out of recession and keeping unemployment low. Not for the sake of the numbers on a page, but for the sake of Australians and their families and their communities. Because joblessness is often not a temporary thing. Once out of the workforce, many people have trouble getting back in. And of course, over time, they lose their skills. Their motivation dwindles. Their life opportunities are diminished. Long after the economy has picked up, there is still human wreckage from a slump. This is, as you know, a very big problem in Europe and, of course, a very big problem in the United States over the coming decade. And, of course, for Australia, it was one of the enduring legacies of the 1990s recession. Now, of course, I know not every element of our measures to save the economy and to save Australian jobs has been perfect. So I do want to address some of those criticisms tonight that have been made of our stimulus programs. And again, in retrospect, it's easy to say some of the things that could or should have been done with greater accuracy or attention to detail. That is clear. But I'm pleased to say that I do live in a country that holds its government to high standards of administration, and long may that be the case. But what I believe has been lost in much of this analysis of what went right or what went wrong is the critical importance of acting with speed to arrest a slide in economic activity, but more importantly, what it did for economic confidence. Yes, more time to devise our response might have meant better administration of a number of programs, but it also would have meant less economic activity and crucial weeks or possibly months lost in the vital task of sustaining confidence in our recovery. Funnily enough, our political opponents did share this analysis. Their sense of our greatest political vulnerability was that stimulus would fail to support activity. And their principal point of political attack was on the failure of our policies to protect jobs. That was the attack that came after the stimulus package of February last year. And for example, Joe Hockey, the Shadow Treasurer, had this to say at the time. The clear evidence from the first two stimulus packages is that they are not creating jobs, they are not preserving jobs. Now, of course, once it was clear that stimulus had in fact averted a recession and in fact had saved jobs, our opponents chose a different political strategy, namely to highlight what they saw as instances of waste in the emergency programs we put in place. And of course, I don't begrudge them doing that, that's their job. And of course, they needed a political argument. But of course, they were right the first time. The yardstick was always jobs and minimising the terrible waste of human and business potential which is inherent in a recession. And on that yardstick, we were very successful indeed. But that wasn't the only major achievement. I won't run through a whole list of what I believe the government did do during that period, but not only did we deliver three lots of personal income tax, fundamental reform across education, particularly in terms of national curriculum, big investments in clean energy initiatives, and so on. My task tonight is not to run through the full list, but I would mention the one that I'm most proud of was the very significant increase in the base rate of pension, something that our political opponents had not found the wit to do in over 12 years of government. But that brings us to the next 3 years, the challenges and the opportunities for our country in the year ahead. First of all, the opportunities. This year, about half the world's growth is expected to come from emerging Asian economies, principally China and India. By 2030, Asia is expected to be the largest economic region in the world, with a GDP larger than the G7 industrial economies combined. Just think about that for a moment. Our increasing integration into this regional economy will continue to dominate our economic development. This is a fantastic opportunity for Australia, the greatest economic opportunity ever offered to Australia in our history. But of course, it's also a pretty hefty challenge. We know the expansion of the regional economy is good for our minerals and for our energy industries. But the whole mining industry is less than one-tenth of our total output. Mining creates well-paid jobs, but all of the mining jobs in the country are only around 1.5% of the total number of jobs. Our challenge, our task, is to develop our economy so that mining benefits, but not only mining. We need to develop so that service industries and services exports, manufacturing and manufacturing exports, agriculture and agricultural exports also benefit. To develop those industries so Australians have well-paid jobs, not just in the mining industry. And that means, first and foremost, that we need national infrastructure that matches the best in the Asian regional economy into which we are integrating our economy. And right now, that's not the case. Singapore and Korea, for example, have much faster broadband than we do. And, of course, it is much more widely available. The same is true of road and rail and port, and about transport networks generally. We do quite well in maths and literacy scores, But we need to build on this to support commercially related research and development capability, which of course is the key to global competitiveness. We need to put a lot more effort into education and training if we're not to be left behind by many of our neighbours. And of course, we do need to be competitive for capital as well, which means we need to keep a close eye on corporate taxation and certainly not lift the company rate for large companies like our opponents are proposing. And of course, we do need to attend to national savings. We may never match national saving in China, Japan and Singapore, but we can do better than we do now. These are all areas in which we need to improve if we are to make the most of the vast opportunities that will be presented by this massive regional economy in what is going to be the Asian century. Now, of course, in all of these areas, Labor has policies and programs. Our national broadband network, absolutely critical. Our path-breaking investments in education, alongside Julia Gillard's vital transparency and national curriculum reforms. A cut in the corporate tax rate, cuts to small business taxation, and superannuation reforms that will give a 30-year-old today nearly $150,000 more in retirement income. And in all of them, these are promises that the opposition promises to reverse, to destroy these programs, and of course to revert to a model of complacent encouragement of consumption, which of course marked 11 years of coalition rule. So all of this is at stake at this point in our national life. There's a choice between two paths. One path that invests in our future, in technology and infrastructure, in education, training and competitiveness, and another which tries to talk down our successes and our economy, and which of course retreats from the challenges, which encourages fear and inwardness and resistance to change. I believe the record of the Labor government elected in 2007, our success in resisting recession, our success in achieving vital reforms in the most adverse circumstances is your assurance that we can meet this great challenge of securing Australia's prosperity in the new Asian Pacific regional economy. Now, of course, I've been reading in the newspapers over the last few days that business leaders are warning of the perils of a minority government. And, of course, it is certainly true that the prospect of a minority government does pose some very unusual and interesting challenges. But I've no doubt that we can be successful and effective in minority government if we are given the support of the crossbenchers. Now, it was often remarked that the wartime Menzies and Fadden governments depended on minorities, and of course they both fell. The Menzies government, of course, did not fall through a vote of the House, but through the disunity of Menzies' own party. The Fadden government certainly fell on the vote of the House, but again, it was widely said that the two independents voted against the Fadden government because of its own disunity. What is not often observed is that the government which then entered office, perhaps the most successful and effective government Australia has ever had, was also a minority government. From October 1941 to the federal election of August 1943, Australia was led by a Labor government without a majority in either the House or the Senate. The Curtin government not only mobilised the country for a war with Japan, the most serious threat in our history, but also introduced uniform taxation and began work on post-war policies that eventually produced the Full Employment White Paper and Australian participation in the IMF, the World Bank, and of course what is now the World Trade Organisation. Ours is a more peaceful challenge, but the stakes are high. These have been turbulent years in the global economy and turbulent ones for Australia as well. And yes, they have been difficult years for our party. But turbulence and difficult times can also reveal strength. When we were fully tested as a government and a Labor Party during the global recession, we made the right calls for Australia. The test before us now is also one of unity and purpose. Yes, minority government is a tougher test than having a thumping majority. So it is worth asking ourselves who is best placed to meet that test. Who is capable of a politics better and broader than the politics of a bare 50% plus one majority and the partisanship that colours our politics? who has a record of choosing and forging consensus rather than confrontation, who has the right plan when it comes to building the economy up as opposed to tearing it down. I believe, of course, that person is our Prime Minister, Julia Gillard. She is better placed to practice the politics of consensus that is demanded by the election on August 21. Our economic plan and our plans more broadly are something for the country to unite behind. We have this great opportunity to harness the Parliament and the goodwill of the people's representatives to build the stronger economy we need. And that's what a returned Labor government under Prime Minister Julia Gillard would do. Thank you.
Many thanks to the Deputy Prime Minister. Deputy Prime Minister has agreed to take some questions, so we'll finish no later than 7, probably a little bit before. We've got plenty of time. But before we go to questions and discussion, I want to say thanks to Clayton Yutz for making this facility available tonight at about 2 days' notice. We put this on a very late notice, and thanks for everyone for coming along and filling out the room. So just question discussion. Thanks for your talk. I can understand, because I want to talk to you because you've been involved with the Prime Minister in the negotiations with the Greens and the Independents. I can understand why you would want to do and have done a deal with Andrew Wilkie. I could understand why you want to do a deal with the Rural Independents, all of them or some of them. But in relation to the Greens, it's not so clear, because tonight, for example, you spoke about the opposition and you mentioned the levy to fund the opposition's paternal leave scheme, but you're now in alliance with the party, the Greens, that actually wants a hefty increase in taxation, individual taxation, company taxation. How's that going to work out? I mean, there's only one Green in the House of Representatives, but you've signed an alliance with the Greens party.
Thanks, Gerard, and could I also thank Clayton Utz for the hospitality tonight. I think we need to really come at this from a slightly different perspective, because we haven't been in this space for a long period of time, I mean, basically since the war. So this is something that's a bit different. But minority government is not something that is unknown at the state level in Australia. Indeed, it's been practiced very successfully by a number of state governments, very successfully by Steve Brax, for example, in Victoria. And we come to this task with what I regard as the national interest as being the overriding imperative, because we respect the result that the electorate delivered last Saturday week. It delivered a result which said that neither party has a majority. In fact, we're even Stephen in the Parliament. Our responsibility is to put forward a program which will draw the support of parties and or independents that can give us enough certainty and continuity to serve for a full 3-year term. And that's what we're seeking to do. We think certainty demands it, stability demands it. For all of the reasons that I've outlined in my talk tonight, we do have some great opportunities before us. And I believe we've got a program which can maximise those opportunities. But we can't do that unless we can form a stable government which can serve with certainty for a 3-year period. So we entered into our discussions with the Greens in the same spirit that we have entered into our discussions with Mr. Wilkie, and of course the same spirit that we have entered into our discussions with the three other independents. And our view is that if we could have support across all of those groups, that maximises the certainty and the stability that we need. So I don't accept that there's something entirely different about what we've done with the Greens on the one hand and what we've currently done today with Mr. Wilkie and what we may or may not be able to do with the independents. We don't expect that there will be agreement between the Labor government, the Greens, the independents or Mr. Wilkie on every policy issue that comes before the Parliament. And in fact, if you have a look at the agreement that we signed with the Greens, it is mainly about process. It's not necessarily about policy outcomes at all. Because we recognise there are some things we are not going to agree on with the Greens, there are some things we're not going to agree on with Mr. Wilkie, and there are some things we don't agree on with any number of those independents in various combinations. What we are seeking is the stability of a parliamentary majority, which can provide us the certainty to get on with the job of governing, But we have to recognise that these groups will need to be more involved in what we do, which is why parliamentary reform has been a very important part of our discussions with all of them. But I don't accept that just because we've signed an agreement with the Greens or Mr Wilkie, or indeed if we were to sign them with the other three independents, that we've all signed up to the same policy agenda. We clearly haven't. The agenda that we took to the people is the agenda we are going to pursue on the floor of the Parliament in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. And that's what we'll do.
Thank you. So there's a question here. Yeah.
Swan,
I think if you just sit down, it's probably easier because there's a cameras behind you. Yeah.
Mr. Swan, tonight you've promoted your credentials or rather the credentials of your government as an economic manager. But business is both great and small. Devise a business plan before they embark on major projects. Why haven't you provided a cost benefits analysis for your national broadband scheme? And indeed, also for the buyback of water rights for the Murray Darling.
The question is, why is there no business plan for the broadband scheme or the buyback of water rights in the Murray-Darling?
Yeah, I've got the question.
For the audience.
There has been a very large implementation study, this has been examined uphill and down dale by all of our professional advisors, as well as those that did the implementation study. They have found that it is viable, so I don't accept that what you call a proper cost-benefit analysis has not been done. I think it's been absolutely thoroughly done, and in fact, in some ways, done to death. And we wouldn't have been reaching an agreement of the magnitude we reached with Telstra unless they were confident that, in fact, there is a very clear path ahead for the national broadband network. So I just don't accept that characterisation. I accept there's what you see as a cost-benefit analysis may not fit perfectly with what has been done, but it is a comprehensive piece of work, and I'll just urge you to look at what is publicly available. I have seen all of the data, and not all of what I've seen will be available to you, but we would not sign off on an investment of this magnitude unless we were satisfied that there was value for money for the country. We simply wouldn't do that. So I think we have done all of that work thoroughly over the past 2.5 years, and we do enjoy the broad support of the business community in this endeavour. We didn't hear much about it in the election campaign because most of the major significant business groups decided they'd say nothing about anything, which was somewhat surprising, even in the face of an increase in the corporate tax rate, which was coming from the Liberals. But when I got out on the ground, anywhere in Australia, what business was talking to me about was broadband. And it wasn't just in Tasmania, which has got the rollout happening right now. It was palpable when you're in Mackay, when you're in Townsville, when you're in Cairns, when you're in Darwin. That's what business was talking to me about. One of the big issues of this election that didn't really surface as a significant point of commentary was the importance of broadband as not just an economic issue and not just an issue of importance to business, but something that attracted all Australians, I believe. It did play a vital role in garnering support for Labor in the campaign, particularly from that small business community. And the further you got away from the major capitals, the hotter the issue was.
There's a question here. We've got plenty of time, so yep.
Mr. Swan, as you outlined, you and your government had a great story to tell about how you handled the GFC over the last 3 years, particularly relative to most other OECD countries. You had a great story to tell about that and a whole lot of other things, yet nevertheless the Aussie public didn't buy it. You had a large swing against you. We've now got a hung parliament. Why is that?
Well, can I just make a couple of points about the election outcome and then come back to the policy issue, which is the most important? You say there was a large swing. There was certainly a swing against the government. The swing against the government was about 2%. When John Howard went to his first election in 1998, it was almost 6%. He lost something like 16 to 18 seats. I'll be corrected by Jerry. Yeah. So let's just get this into perspective. I'm not saying that the Australian people didn't vote against the government in some numbers. They did. And was there clearly dissatisfaction with the government? Yes, there was. But was this one of those big swings that we've seen in post-war elections where a government was thrown out or thumped? No, it wasn't. But, of course, we must acknowledge the things that we got wrong. We must acknowledge the things that we got right. And you made the point to me, why then wasn't the vote greater for us? Why was there a 2% swing, given what a strong economic record you have? And I do believe we have a strong economic record. I believe that's why we are still in the hunt for government. People voted for that economic record. Let me just tell you a few stories as I moved around Australia. Now, there have been plenty who have been willing to highlight what they say is waste in stimulus. I tell you what, when I went around Australia and I was walking down the streets and talking particularly to small business, I lost count of the number of times people directly approached me and said, "Mr. Swan, if it wasn't for what you were doing in terms of social housing or the BER, my business would be closed right now." I believe large numbers of Australians did understand that we did cushion very substantially the impact of the global recession on this country. And we kept the doors of tens of thousands of businesses open, which otherwise would have closed. And it is responsible principally for the fact that today we have an unemployment rate of 5.3% when you have an unemployment rate in the US approaching 10 and far higher in many parts of Europe. I believe that is why we were still competitive in the election campaign, because people did recognise that. And indeed, if you want to go back and even look at some of the polling that was going on during the campaign, it showed that during the course of the campaign, Labor's support on the economy continued to improve. My point is, I think they did recognise what we did during the global recession, but they were sending us messages about a whole series of issues, and the economy wasn't the only issue in the campaign. I'm not a commentator, so I'm not going to run through what I think were the major causes of the swing, but what we do is respect the decision of the people, and we get on with the job. For us, getting on with the job is not just strengthening the economy, broadening and strengthening the economy, preparing for mining boom Mark II as we must, but it is also dealing with many of those other issues that concern Australians, from climate change all the way through.
There's a question here.
Yeah. Mr. Swan, Fiona Wayne from Environment Australia. Thanks for your address. Could we just look at the global economy recession and the potential negative of a double dip recession, but then the given absolute positive of the green economy that a number of countries and blocs like the EU are very actively pursuing? And I would suggest that Australia is incredibly well placed to be one of the lead players in that green economy. But the decision to defer the CPRS and to defer putting the price on carbon has sent a lot of investment offshore, and if that capital then gets spent in Japan, Korea, China, Europe, Africa even, it's not then going to come back to Australia. So can we please have a price set on carbon so that, as Nick Stern says, we're starting to address the very perverse subsidies that create so much market failure today?
That could keep me going for about an hour.
There's a question about, for those you didn't hear on our podcast, there's a question about a price on carbon. Okay.
Sure. The first point is we didn't defer the CPRS. It was voted down in the Senate not once, but twice, not twice, three times. And that occurred, I think the latest vote on it was at the end of last year, around December. We then had the debacle of Copenhagen and the complete fracturing, not just of the domestic consensus about climate change, but the international consensus. You are speaking to someone who sat at the meetings in the lead-up to Copenhagen, through the G20 finance ministers process, who was arguing vehemently in those processes to ensure that we got a decent outcome out of Copenhagen. So I can tell you where the consensus was fractured and who fractured it. And Australia, through all of those international meetings, did everything we possibly could to progress it. So I don't accept for one second the notion that somehow, because Tony Abbott and the Liberals changed their leadership and with the Greens voted down the CPRS, that we are somehow responsible for that. I do accept responsibility, however, for getting this issue back on the rails. So does the Prime Minister, and we're determined to do it. But what we've got to do is recreate not only a domestic consensus, but an international consensus, which is completely fractured. And when I go off to the next lot of G20 meetings, this will start to come up again. And we will be there trying to get a global consensus so we can move forward. So I just don't accept that characterisation, although I know it is shared by many Australians. So I welcome the opportunity to give you my perspective of what actually happened, because it was voted down not once, twice, three times. I sat through all of the meetings that developed the Green Paper, that developed the White Paper, that developed the legislation, that was involved in all of the debates. We could not have done more domestically than we did. But sadly, for a variety of reasons, that consensus has fractured. I do agree with you that green jobs and green technology can be a great enabler of new business and new employment and new wealth creation. That's why we've managed to get the RET in place. That's why we've put in place a new fund in terms of trying to give a very big boost to renewables. I could take you through a lot of that. But I believe this path through investment in technology and renewables is part of the answer to solving many of the challenges that I was just talking about.
Got to keep our questions brief. So there and then, John. Yeah.
Evening, Mr. Swan. I was just wanting to see your view on the Treasury information about the $11 billion black hole in the news last night and today.
No, that's not allowed because we've banned Dorothy Dix's. It's
a national parliamentary reform happening.
I've never met Mr. Swan in my life.
Yeah, he's never Dorothy Dix.
But I'm delighted to answer this very incisive question. As you know, we had a very big debate about costings in the campaign because the Liberals, frankly, were refusing to undergo any scrutiny because they knew their numbers didn't add up. So they invented a whole story about a police investigation and a leak from the Treasury as a cover for the fact that they didn't participate in the Charter of Budget Honesty, which would have had the Treasury examine all of their policies and tell the Australian people before the election that there was a big hole. All of our policies went through that charter. They've all been signed off. We've had a net save, not of $44 million over the Ford estimates, but of $106 million through examination by Treasury. Treasury has found that of their $11.6 billion worth of claimed net savings, there's a hole of $10.6 billion. That is $9 in every 10 of claimed savings from the Liberals is inaccurate and wrong. You know, if they aspire to govern this country, they've got to be better at a result than getting one thing in ten right. Right? Which is what the Treasury has said. That is, in their savings, they got $1 in ten right in their savings. That is what the Treasury has found. This is a damning indictment of the Liberal Party. And that's how you answer it, Dorothy Dixon.
There's been history formed here tonight because this is the last Dorothy Dixon ever asked in Australia. After the... Now there's John and then we go down the back. We've got to keep... Yeah, okay, John. Yep.
Treasurer, I think the conflict from last year said he couldn't get a pre-selection of the Labor Party these days. The other night on Q&A, Malcolm Fraser said, oh, my Labor Party says they haven't got enough candidates that have real life work experience for a period of time. Have you ever thought about putting the first one or two Senate tickets aside for people who have performed outstandingly in Australia and to provide depth of cabinet?
I don't accept that characterisation of our side of federal politics at all.
No, I'm saying that.
No, but I'm saying at the moment I think we are the exception, and you'd expect me to say that, but let me just put the case.
Yeah.
I think we have a very talented federal caucus. I was first elected to Parliament in 1993. I was then defeated in 1996. I was re-elected in 1998. And in all of that time there, I don't think we've ever had a more diverse, talented, interesting backbench than we have now. And that's surprising, because the truth is, if you look around more widely, I think it is true that there is a dearth of interested, intelligent, diverse people coming into politics elsewhere, but they have come to our federal caucus, and that's going to be very important for our federal parliamentary Labor Party in the years to come. We have some terrific candidates running for us this time, some of whom actually won, because many of them got many were defeated, but I just take someone like, say, Deb O'Neill up in Robertson. Really good candidate. Solid community involvement. Fantastic. Take David Bradbury out there in Lindsay, who everyone wrote off for the whole of the election campaign. Here is a guy of outstanding commitment to his local community. Very talented. Could have stopped in corporate life and earned a lot of money, but no, he's dedicated to community. On our side, I think we're reasonably well served, but we shouldn't be complacent about it, which is why I think there's a validity to your question underneath it all. What do we do to make our parties more representative of the community? What do we do to attract more people to come into public life, which these days is lived in the glare of 24-hour television? there are very significant disincentives for people, not just in terms of their family life, but just in terms of the way in which public life evolves, for anybody to consider it. Because it's not like it was when Curtin or Menzies were around and they'd take a 3-day train ride home to their electorate. Everything is done in full public glare, and that's a very significant disincentive. The pace of life, as it is for everybody, is so strong. It's a very significant disincentive for anyone who has young children, and I believe that disqualifies particularly a lot of women who could make an even more make a very important contribution in public life. So all of these things are part and parcel of it. It's not the stereotypical view that you have just put, that somehow there's a big machine out there and it's got this sort of standard stamp and it spits out this standard candidate that turns up and, you know, and you would regard isn't very good. That's not the problem.
Just by way of background, there was one thing missing from Malcolm Fraser's comment, complaint that people went straight from university into politics. He went straight from Oxford into politics and was in Parliament at the age of 25.
Exactly.
And sort of just forgot.
But that's not a bad thing, because there are plenty of people who've done that who are really good. But the point is that stereotypical view that you put isn't the problem. And if that continues to define the problem, we'll never solve it.
So we go there and then the back of the room, then Anne and then Penny and then down the back. We've got to move quickly. Yeah.
Oh, look, this is going on from that. I can see where you're coming from, but having talked to one of your most senior former position holders just a couple of months ago, who was hugely, hugely disenchanted with the way the Labor Party has got federally and statewide, whatever. It was sort of like a cry from the heart. There is a problem, and it's partly from what you just said, that increasingly politics is becoming a very narrowed profession. You have to deal with 24-hour news. You have to deal with life away more and more and more from your ordinary, normal living. I can't imagine what it must be like to live as a senior minister, especially in the last few weeks, where your life is completely and utterly two-dimensionally to your job. How do you break that when you've got a world which has become so much
more complex?
It's true.
That is just very accurate, the way in which you've described it. And as someone in politics who's exactly in that position, you've got to find ways to break out. You've got to find ways where you just don't turn up at the standard places that you're expected to turn up. Like, I've always had a maxim, as a marginal seat holder, which I've always been, it's not what people who ring you say on the phone. It's the ones who don't ring you. That's the challenge. And the challenge in politics is to get out and to talk to the people that don't naturally reach out to talk to you. And, of course, when you get to my position, you are naturally more and more isolated from many of those contacts that you'd normally have, just from, say, working, basically, you know, most days and nights, and in going to all the things that people expect you to do as treasurer. You're expected to attend a certain number of functions over here, a certain number of functions over there. And if you don't, you're deemed to have not been doing your job. But the fact is, if you are not balancing that with other activities where you're not expected to be, but where you will get to hear things that you wouldn't otherwise hear, then you do get caught in that trap. I'm very conscious of that, and I'm conscious of it particularly because I spent a large part of 2009, or virtually all of them, in a 24-hour cycle dealing with the global recession and little else. And that meant I didn't have time to do some of the other things I'd normally be doing. And I'm absolutely determined as I go through this term, because I don't think there'll be a double dip, to take the opportunity to get a bit more balance into the way in which I get out and about into the community. I don't just mean that geographically, although geographically is very important. It also means the type of places that you go and what people are doing there, from sport all the way through to small business, chambers of commerce, you name it. What you've got to do is try and broaden that out as the natural counter to this sort of wall that builds itself around you. And if you're not careful, you know, after 6 months, you say, oh, who did I meet in the last 6 months? You know, that wasn't sort of particularly different. So you've really got to make sure that you're aware of it and put in place strategies in terms of your own diary and profile to combat it.
Penelope.
This is day 13 since the election. Do you think we'll have an outcome by this time next week?
Yes. I hope so.
So there's down the back there. Yeah.
Over the last 10 years, 10 weeks or so, I've heard lots about the debt in Australia, percentage of GDP, and $100,000 income to borrow $6,000. Why doesn't Australia borrow more money and invest in infrastructure and build the trains and build the infrastructure we actually need, given we have such a high capacity to cover the debt?
Well, there's a couple of answers there, but let me just tell you why we have put in place a very strong fiscal consolidation. We did go substantially into debt as a result of the global recession, and most of that debt is not due to what we spent on stimulus. It's due to the fact that we had a complete collapse of taxation revenues. So the deficits that we are running are principally caused by a collapse in taxation revenue caused by the global recession, and about a quarter of it is actually the money we spent on stimulus. Because if we hadn't have borrowed, then we would have had to have either jacked up taxes dramatically, which would have slowed the economy, or cut spending on services dramatically, which would have slowed the economy. That's the case for stimulus. That's why we went substantially into deficit. But it's very important, particularly in the global environment, to make sure that you keep your budget in good shape over the medium term. So you can go into, and should in some occasions go into deficit, but when things are getting much better, then that's when you should be building up some reserves for the future, that is, you go back to surplus. What we're doing at the moment is we're charting a course back to surplus where we'll be in 2013. What we've said is that's important and that we do need to consolidate, just so you've got that buffer if times turn bad. You've raised a separate question from that as to whether you might want to borrow to do things like we've just done with the NBN. What we've just done with the NBN is in fact what you are advocating. That is, we are going to borrow to invest in a piece of critical national infrastructure so that we can make sure that we put in place that infrastructure which the rest of the community will benefit from. But we have to be very careful of making sure that when good times return and growth returns to above trend, which it is doing in this country, we start to build up our surpluses again. So that if we get an adverse event that comes down the track, we've got the capacity to deal with it like we've just done.
Jacqueline.
Treasurer, you talked about the booms that Australia is going to be preparing for. Where are we going to get the people to be able to fill these jobs? There was an analysis that came out earlier this week that talked about definite skills deficit in the country. We're reducing migration and making skills migration even more difficult.
No, we're not.
How do we get these people to regions? And one of the reasons I ask that is that some of the regions are employing people like me to try and attract more work to the regions, when the fact is there aren't any.
Well, we're not reducing skilled migration. The previous migration program was essentially watered and distorted by a number of elements under the previous government, namely some of the visas that went to foreign students and so on, which, you know, basically meant that we were bringing in a lot of people who didn't have the skills that we were looking for, instead of bringing in people that had the skills that we were looking for. So we have actually recalibrated our skilled migration program, and as the economy demands, we've got the capacity to move that up or down. So when we first came to power, we moved it up. When the recession came along, we moved it down. And depending upon the needs, we will increase, if necessary, skilled migration categories. But first and foremost, what a country must do is train its own people. Now, there will be demands over and above what we can train from our own people, but we need to do both. We need to train all the Australians who can be trained and should be trained. There are still pockets of this country where unemployment is relatively high, and we have to do more to train people in those regions. We've got to do both.
So, final question here. Yeah.
Treasurer, Professor Fred Gilmore in the last days gave a talk with this institute and basically suggested that the ability to contract between an employer and employee was an important driver in lifting productivity as an incentive to lift productivity. You're talking about Labor's plan for the economy going into the future tonight. Do you accept that there might be a place in the future for reintroduction of individual contracts into workplaces to drive productivity higher if the economy is looking as though it needs that reform?
I've never been a great fan of the thesis that said the whip and the lash in the workplace is what delivered the increased productivity.
I've never really been a fan of that. I think workplaces can be productive when people have some decent working conditions.
I think compared to Professor Hilmer, he was talking about mining sites where people are well paid. He wasn't talking about the mines.
Sure, well...
I mean, he wasn't talking about the Industrial Revolution mines.
Well, employment is expanding dramatically under the Fair Work Act. There's 500,000 jobs that have been created since the government was elected. We've got record job creation going on. I'm not sure that the industrial relations system that we've brought in is a huge disincentive to that.
Okay, I think that stops. So many thanks to the Deputy Prime Minister. I'll be very brief. There's a lot of talk about a new paradigm, its process and all that. But what we saw tonight is the Deputy Prime Minister come along, give a talk and take nearly half an hour questions and answer all of them. So, and take them from the floor on a whole range of issues. So I'm very grateful that Wayne Swan came along here tonight, told us what the government's thinking, what he's thinking as Treasurer and Deputy Prime Minister, both now and into the future. And I think it's also fair to acknowledge that over the last 3 years, Mr. Swan has made quite a substantial impact representing Australia in the G20 meetings. And as someone who travels, you hear very favourable reports about the Deputy Prime Minister's contribution as Treasurer in the G20 and representing Australia, which has been an important role in his many responsibilities. But Wayne Swan's always been a friend of the Sydney Institute. We're very grateful he came here tonight, and we're looking forward to him coming back in the future. But for tonight, well done and congratulations.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.